Right, well, my name's Tony Gosling. I'm a freelance journalist in Bristol, former BBC radio reporter, and I do a programme called Friday Drive Time on the community radio here, which is a two-hour current affairs programme every week. And what I'd like to talk about today is basically how history has been mistaught to people. And there's a very famous philosopher who said that education is a system of imposed ignorance. So what we're taught in different parts of the world, as you, if you go and have a look at the curriculums that's taught in our schools, particularly primary, secondary, you know, sort of schools that everybody goes to, you'll find there's a lot of stuff missing from history, and also, you know, there are threads throughout history which are just disjointed by the way the curriculum is presented. So we're living in a kind of crazy world in 2011, where, I mean, for example, just we're in January now, and we've just heard that the police infiltrated a protest to such an extent that they were actually instigating the protest, helping very much with the planning of it. So to what extent are £2 million or something spent on a police infiltrator, to what extent are they actually watching what's going on and using this to gather intelligence, and to what extent are they actually instigating the protests? This is one of the things we've really got to worry and wonder about, and we see the same within terrorist groups particularly, where it comes to light through things like Operation Gladio, that the authorities, the intelligence services and the police are not just observing when they infiltrate these groups, they are actually controlling the groups and determining their direction. And of course, in many of the cases that we've seen, I mean, this protest camp, the climate camp thing, is a very good example, because of the intelligence of the actual activists. They exposed this policeman infiltrator. Many of these, of course, the infiltrators are never exposed. They may even do a prison sentence as part of their job. And we've heard today that it's about £250,000 a year of public money is spent on one police infiltrator. So it gives us an idea of this kind of strange world we're living in, where the authorities actually seem to be turning against the population, even though we're supposed to be living in a democracy. That's one example. We had another really crazy example with Toyota cars, where some of the more modern Toyotas were actually accelerating up to 120 miles an hour without the occupants even putting their foot on the accelerator pedal. So this was put across to the public as, oh, we've got slightly sticky accelerators. But what's actually happening is that you've got a computer-controlled car where your accelerator is just simply a switch which requests the computer to actually accelerate your car. We can't be living in this crazy world where technology is actually killing us in situations like that, and Toyota should make sure in future that all the major safety mechanisms in a car, like brakes, steering and accelerator, are actually controllable by the person driving the car, not by some computer. There's another example in January 2011, that is, we're just hearing that the private bank, which has been nationalised, the Royal Bank of Scotland, the boss stands to get something like a £7 million bonus this January. Now, we've had all the rhetoric from all the politicians, Conservative, Labour, Liberal, about how they're going to rein back bankers' bonuses. And yet, the one we're paying his salary, the public, the Treasury, is in control of this bank. They are still allowing this guy to walk away with a £7 million bonus. Absolutely unbelievable, and it just shows that democracy is just becoming a total facade. So why is this? Anyway, I want to have a look through history at two threads of history, which are money and land, and we'll talk about more about that in a minute. Okay, money and land. What I'm saying is that these are two ways throughout history which have been slowly used to control people. It's sort of clenching down on the population. And firstly, land, because land everybody needs. I mean, it's even down there in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, everyone's right to shelter. Obviously, if you're going to have a shelter, you need land. And you also need a secure place to live. This is one of the most fundamental things in the world we're living today, is we know that if we have somewhere secure to live, we look after the place. If you go around many of the private rented sectors around Britain, you'll see that they are very dilapidated. That the private landlords don't actually care, because they're not using the building themselves, and so they often don't get maintained, they look a mess. If you've got security of tenure for you, your successors, your children, etc., if you can stay where you're living at the moment, you know, forever, then you look after the place. And the reason that we're now on this very insecure system where you have to pay the rent every week, sometimes you don't, maybe every month, sometimes you don't know if you're going to be able to pay that rent, that creates a tremendous amount of instability in society. It's a very short-term way of a tiny number of landlord people actually making money off the backs of others. It's a very bad system and it's a totally unequal system. We've got something like 60 million acres of land in Britain, and yet only something like 0.5% of the population owns nearly half of all the land. What we need to do is have some sort of program to redistribute that land so that people have got somewhere secure that they can first of all live, secondly somewhere secure that they can do some work if they want to, and thirdly somewhere where they can even possibly grow food, this kind of thing. So this is what we mainly need land for. We also need it to walk on, leisure at the weekends in the countryside. But we do need access to land for all sorts of reasons, most importantly a home and a security of tenure. So if we go back right the way back, how did we get to this crazy position throughout history? The main, I think if we go right the way back to Old Testament times, you'll see in the book of Leviticus that there's something called the Jubilee in Leviticus 25. And this recognised back in Old Testament times that there was no point, you should never be able to sell land permanently. And what it actually says is that the land is God's and that the human beings on the planet are just God's tenants in a way. So the idea that it's your land to sell permanently is totally outlawed in the Bible, in the book of Leviticus. But this is something which has kind of slowly but surely over the years been forgotten. And the importance of it has been forgotten. But actually many of us now are acknowledging and remembering that it is actually very important. So that was remedied by the Jubilee. So you could sell a piece of land to a neighbour for a while, but after every 50 years it would be returned to its original owner. So there's no way you could permanently sell land. And this is something really, really important that we have to understand. That if we are actually part of a country, any country in the world, then actually we need to have an investment and security of tenure in the land of that country. Otherwise, that being part of that country doesn't really mean anything. And this has been slowly taken away from us over the years. And of course, one of the things that that's meant is that we are now much more dependent on money than we ever used to be. Now, money first really caught on in Britain after the Roman invasion around about 50 AD. But even before that, in around about 30 AD, Jesus threw the money changers out of the temple. Now, this was the only time that Jesus got really angry during his ministry. The goldsmiths in Jerusalem had monopolised the supply of a coin called the half shekel of the sanctuary, which worshippers needed to pay taxes in the temple. So they had to do sacrifices. But for those sacrifices, they needed to use this coin. But the money changers had monopolised supply of it, so they were racking up the price of this little coin. And that's one of the reasons that Jesus got so annoyed, is because they're basically using what's going on in the temple to monopolise the supply of something and to make profits, unwarranted profits. And of course this is a similar situation we're in today with things like gas, electricity, the railways, is that where you've got these private monopolies or cartels who are actually jacking up the price of all these products because the government regulation is so incredibly weak now. So when the Romans invaded, there was a lot of resistance in Britain by the Iceni in East Anglia, who were a tribe, and also the Ordovice in North Wales. These were very agile tribes. They didn't have any specific capital or base, so they were able to harry the Romans for many, many years after the invasion. But Roman tributes, the money system, started to begin to come in. We go up to near 1,000 years or so, then we come to the time of the Doomsday Book. That was just after the Norman invasion. Now, the Doomsday Book was called Doomsday by the people who lived in those days because it had connotations to do with the end of the world. This is what a lot of the local people in Britain were called it, nicknamed it Doomsday, because there's no appeal. Once something was written down as a tax in the Doomsday Book, you had to pay it. There was no question. Even if you had a bad harvest, etc., you had to pay your tax. And this was seen as very unfair because there was no right of appeal. This is why people nicknamed it Doomsday. And there were riots across Britain as these commissioners went around collecting all the information for the Doomsday Book. Go on a little bit to 1070 and 1071, and the results of Doomsday really were horrific. There was a resistance to the Norman invasion by people like Hereward the Wake, based in Ely, because I think, you know, often we accept the Norman invasion as just simply it happened, but there were people who were extremely angry about it and saw it as a sort of infiltration and takeover of the country. Hereward caused all sorts of problems for the Romans. They had to send loads of, for the Normans. They had to send loads of soldiers to fight him, and eventually he just melted away into the fens in East Anglia after causing them so much hassle. And I think really, it's been fair to say that there's been a tradition of resistance against this kind of Roman-Norman elitist establishment ever since these times. In 1118, it was an important day. It was the date that the Knights Templar were founded, and this was formed by Hugo de Payens. It was the first multinational bank. Now, the Knights Templar were thought of as a sort of chivalric order of honourable knights, but they weren't actually. They were a private armed army, and they're still around today in the form of orders of Freemasonry. They started in Britain, in Strand, just near the Strand, somewhere called the Temple in London. Bristol here, we are quite famous for having Temple Meads, which was where the Knights Templar were based here in Bristol. And they had bases in other countries in Europe and, of course, in Jerusalem. And the reason that they are thought of as the first multinational corporation is you could pay your money in Bristol and you could trot out to the Holy Land and you could withdraw it from the Templar Bank in Jerusalem. So they were able to cross all sorts of borders. The other thing was they were trusted, or at least they were one of the bunches of people that were trusted, by lots of kings and queens to look after all their wealth, their gold, and this kind of thing, right across Europe. So they had a network of power, and they were very, because of course they were looking after all the riches of the kings and queens, they were very trusted by those kings and queens, and so they could do all sorts of stuff right across borders, and they had certain forms of immunity. There is an expression as well called drunk as a Templar, which people used to use in medieval times because they were seen to be in some way above the law, a little bit like some people seem to be today, you know, with impunity in Pinochet in South America and places like that. So on we go to, and this is of course to do with money and the control of money. But there was something else going on in England, and this is one of the reasons why we had the Industrial Revolution here, was because of enclosure. Enclosure is the privatisation of land. Land which was shared amongst people in a village, then it was enclosed. And the first one of those enclosures, or privatisations, was in 1235. That's the Statute of Merton, in just out near Surrey somewhere, and done by Henry III. So this is actually a momentous occasion where Parliament decided, and the King decided, that it was okay to take land which was used by all the commoners, everybody in a village, and actually make it the property of one specific individual after that. Now, land is a funny thing, isn't it? Because, I mean, we can have property, like we can have books, you know, that's a piece of property, but is the land under our feet the same kind of thing? Well, I would argue no, it isn't. What is your property is something that you have made, owned, or bought. But the idea that you can own something which is the land under your feet seems very strange, particularly if it's a corporation that owns it. I mean, what's happening the way that corporate greed is going nowadays in banking is that we're going to end up with one giant corporation owning all the land under our feet and no private individuals owning hardly anything. In fact, we're in a situation now where most people actually don't own any land at all, even though we all need it to live on. Some people, even who think they do own the land, this is people with mortgages and property, actually they don't. The bank owns the land. They are just an agent of the banks managing the land, and they're repaying a loan. But say, for example, they lose their income, as many people are doing in the recession. Suddenly, they realise they never owned that land in the first place because the deeds are in the possession of the bank. And they never did actually own the land. They were just a sort of part-time tenant on it who was subletting it to the people who were using it. So you have a very strange psychology with land. A lot of people that say, oh, I own my own home, don't actually own their own home, even though they like to think they do. And this, of course, is part of the sales tactics of the mortgage companies to get you to take out a mortgage is because you think you own your own home. Actually, you don't. And this is partly because the word mortgage is a French word, which means the grip of death. It's a kind of trick, a mortgage and money lending. And of course, back in the old days, when church law was still around, and under many other types of law, like Sharia law, and in Jewish law, for example, interest is illegal. So you're not allowed to charge interest, and you wouldn't be allowed to have a mortgage if we were back in medieval times. So that was the first privatisation of land, the Statute of Merton in 1235. Let's roll on another few years to 1312, and this is when the Templars, the Knights Templar I mentioned before, were dissolved by Philip the Fair of France. The Grand Master was Jacques de Molay of the Knights Templar, and he was executed. And there were all sorts of reasons why, because the Knights Templar had become much too powerful back in 1312. This was a very big, bad thing for the Templars, because they were then on the run right across Europe. And many people believe they went to Spain and then came, and some of the leaders of the Templars settled in Scotland in a place called Roslyn Chapel after that. But many of us obviously escaped, but many were also burnt at the stake, because the order was found actually to be an occult order, not a Christian order at all, where part of the initiation was doing things like spitting on the cross and various other disgusting anti-Christian acts. And that was the reason why Philip the Fair of France decided to extinguish the Templars and get them all arrested. And the French paid the price later on in history, which I'll tell you about later. So, 1312, the Templars were dissolved, and many were executed for their criminal behaviour behind the guise of this holy Christian order, which of course they weren't. Now, after that, something quite interesting happened here in Britain. In 1348, the Order of the Garter was formed. Now, this was around the time of Edward III, and there were all sorts of myths about how this happened, to do with the garter being round a lady's leg and it falling off. But actually, of course, the garter is a symbol, as some people may know, in witchcraft. It's very clear to me that this was just simply another order, rather similar to the Templars that created. In fact, there are 26 knights of the garter, which equals two covens, two witches' covens. So it does look as if, ever since the time of Edward III, this Order of the Garter, which is based in Windsor Castle, has been very much associated with the control of the British Crown ever since that time by a different order, but along similar lines to the Templars. They're not there to protect the Crown. They are there to control the Crown. And there are many people, if you can have a look at the list of today of people who are members of the Order of the Garter, they're all sort of dodgy, suspicious characters. I don't think that there's any one single person who you could say is incredibly honourable and chivalrous and deserves that kind of role. So it's very difficult, I think, for the royal family to really be their own people with these 26 members of the Order of the Garter constantly following them around and so-called protecting them. It's a kind of protection you might get from gangsters rather than from some honourable knights, like, you know, something like the Myth of the Round Table or whatever. Later on in the 1300s, we had the Peasants' Revolt. The situation in Britain was getting worse and worse, really heavy taxes. And down in Kent, Wat Tyler and some of his friends got organised with a massive resistance, and they took over large parts of London and demanded various things from the king, where they were promised that there would be more kindness given back to the peasants. But then, of course, the king reneged on his promise and had Wat Tyler arrested and murdered. I would say murdered, because I don't think it's justice. He was representing literally thousands and thousands of peasants and trying to negotiate with the king. And of course, the king, because he was powerful, reneged on the deal. So that was 1381. Go forward a few more years to Martin Luther in Germany. That's 1520. This is where the Protestant Reformation started. And this is really strange, because the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church, both of them are flawed. Of course, anything earthly is bound to be flawed. We've got problems with the Pope, but the problem with the Protestant Church under Martin Luther is that they seem to be rather more anxious to admit occultists to the Church than the Catholics had been. So whilst we get, you know, the one bad thing with the Catholics, we've got other bad things with the Protestants. That was 1520. Then 1535, we had a massive changes here in Britain, the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry VIII. That was 1535 to 40. Now this meant a massive change in the country because it meant that no longer were the monasteries going to be independent. They were all taken over and controlled by the king. This affected 900 different monastic communities across the country, which was the equivalent of about 9,000 monks and nuns. And of course, the big bonus for the king was this brought in £90,000 per year extra for the king. That was the real, I think, the real reason for the Reformation. It's because it meant that the king was now, in Britain anyway, was running things, not the Catholic Church. So we move on a bit later in that century, and 1549, there was something called Kett's Rebellion in Norfolk. East Anglia was ruled from under an oak tree by a landowner called Robert Kett. Kett had been a very good friend of the peasants around that area, and he'd always been complaining when land was enclosed. We're going back to talk about land enclosure, privatisation again. What happened when the land was enclosed was it was privatised, it was given to a big landowner, and whereas they had open fields before, fences and ditches went up, and there were all sorts of problems because the peasants no longer had land they could cultivate. Often it was turned over to sheep and livestock rather than people being able to grow their own food, being able to grow crops. So the rebellion lasts for about a month and a half, involved many thousands of the local peasants, and actually they actually decided, oh, well, we can, Robert Kett can actually run East Anglia from under an oak tree, and he did. The landowners who'd been enclosing, privatising their land up until the rebellion, many of them were arrested, and they were quite properly tried, questioned, and some of them were imprisoned for stealing the land. Basically, the peasants were saying, well, look, you know, this is the very basic stuff that we need to live on, and if you're going to take it, privatise it, that's theft. Anyway, after about 6 weeks, 2 months, and several attempts by the Crown to take over Norfolk to get rid of Robert Kett, they were then beaten back by the peasants with their pitchforks. After about 6 weeks, finally an army from all over the country was mustered by the king and sent to put down the rebellion. And eventually Robert Kett, for his trouble, trying to keep the land for the people, was strung up by chains from the walls of Norwich. And all the landowners that had been stealing the land were then let out by the king and allowed to carry on their dirty work. And the ditches that had been filled in by the peasants, what happened, the fences went up, the ditches went in, those were all returned by the peasants as part of the revolt. They flattened the land so that the land was open again, and all the fences started going up again after the rebellion, the Kett's Rebellion in 1649 with Robert Kett. And Kett's Oak, I believe, near Wyndham is still there, actually just south of Norwich. So we move on now to the English Civil War. Now, the English Civil War in the 1600s started in 1642, ended in 1649, but the problems that led to it began in the 1630s. Again, this was King Charles I doing something to try and stop enclosure. Enclosure was seen as something very bad in those days by many people who could see that it was taking away a whole peasant class, meaning that these peasants, people who had been landowners, had been able to grow their own food, have somewhere to live, were actually being taken off the land and being sold into employment. So they had to buy, they had to work for a big landowner in order to get some money to buy some food. At no point was any of the food that they were growing, the livestock they were working on, no point was it theirs. They didn't have direct access. They had to go through a lord of the manor of some sort. So King Charles I actually started fining landowners who were privatising land, started fining the enclosing landowners, quite big fines, and saying to them, well, look, you know, if you don't want to pay the fine, just let the peasants back onto the land. And this was happening in the 1630s. There's many references for this, some of which I've put up on the internet, but it's quite an obscure fact. Many people don't realise that this was going on before the English Civil War. So war actually broke out in 1642 between the feudal classes. I mean, some people call it a revolution, of course it wasn't. It was a civil war between the two main classes at the time, which was the merchant classes, which you would encapsulate with the City of London, and the feudal classes, the old feudal barons, the dukes, and the lords of the manor across the country were very much divided. Some of them supported the moneyed classes and the enclosers of the land, and others supported the king, people who thought that actually the peasants should be able to keep their land, and wanted the status quo, a kind of conservative force versus a very radical, let's get everybody off the land, then they can come and work for us. And so ultimately, through the Civil War, the merchants won. And after the English Civil War, there was a rapid acceleration in enclosure. But one thing that did happen during that time was there were a lot of radical thinkers, a lot of radical thinking going on during the English Civil War. In 1645, which was in the middle of the war, the Levellers emerged. They were against the distinctions of class and wealth. They were led by Lieutenant General in Cromwell's army, John Lilburn, who's also known as Freeborn John. Richard Overton and William Walwyn, who were pamphleteers and writers, saying, well, hang on a minute, if we're going to have a civil war, we want something better at the end of it. We don't want something worse. And they could see it was going that way, towards complete control of the country by the merchant classes, by the moneyed people, and that the ordinary people were not going to get much of a say. There was also the diggers in 1649 under Gerard Winstanley, who said, the earth is a common treasury for all. Now, Winstanley was going back in a way to Leviticus, saying, look, the earth everybody needs, the land everybody needs, so let's just use this opportunity to share it out. We've not got a king anymore, and the king was the landowner of all of Britain, so now let's just share out the land. But of course that didn't happen. The merchant classes closed in on Winstanley and his diggers, who'd taken a bit of common land in St George's Hill in Surrey, which is now a private gated estate. It's like the Beverly Hills of Britain, incidentally, which is ironic since that was where the freedom of the land movement in the Civil War started. And so Winstanley eventually ended up as a Quaker, but his protests and his pamphlets have gone right down the years. In fact, you can see much of the history of the Civil War is all about this struggle over land and about equality in the country. Actually, it ended up Cromwell and the parliamentarians winning and ignoring all of the calls of the calls of the soldiers, and the ordinary people who'd fought for him were ignored. And there is a lot of literature about this. After the Second World War, Christopher Hill wrote a book called The World Turned Upside Down. There's a book by Brailsford, which is called The Levellers and the English Revolution, which talks about this. There's very, very little known and taught in history about all this period. But Brailsford's book particularly goes into all of the very nitty-gritty detail of what struggles were going on within the army, what this English Civil War was really all about. And there's also a film called Winstanley, made by Kevin Brownlow in the 1970s. It was a very interesting film because it was made in black and white, and it was made with all volunteer labour making the film, and many volunteer actors apart from one or two professional actors in the lead role. So that's well worth watching if you want to understand what the English Civil War was really all about. And of course, it was a very important war historically because it was the first time that an entire country was controlled by the merchant classes. Now, up until then, you'd had city-states, which were very much ruled like places like Venice and Bristol, who were, you know, not necessarily entirely controlled, but run to a large extent by the merchants. When Cromwell and his faction took over Britain, that was the first time that the merchant classes, in other words, not a king, not a feudal system, had been running the country. And that's one of the reasons why enclosure rapidly increased, because this was very lucrative for the merchants. If they could kick everybody off the land, they had loads of cheap labour, and also they had that land to do what they wanted with. And the reason they managed to do this was because only landowners could vote in Parliament. So basically the peasants were totally disenfranchised and cheated by the English Civil War. So the diggers and the levellers were probably the two most important movements in the Civil War. The other thing is, of course, that This led to mass urbanisation afterwards, Britain and the Industrial Revolution. The fact that we managed, through the Civil War, to kick all the peasants off the land through enclosure meant that you had loads and loads and loads of labourers desperate to work. So yeah, and you also had a division of wealth. You had the factory merchant classes who could build factories. They had plenty of money to do almost anything they wanted with, and then plenty of very, very cheap labour, these poor peasants who were desperate for a little bit of money to survive, to work for them. So the English Civil War was very, very important, and of course it was one of the reasons why we had the agricultural revolution and industrial revolution here in Britain, and why that led to the biggest empire the world's ever seen, where we went round taking over bits of the world here, there and everywhere, and became the bullies of the world for a while. You know, this whole prominence of Britain was due to what happened during the English Civil War and the power that the merchants got from the English Civil War. Despite a lot of people saying it was a battle over religious ideas, it wasn't at all. It was just a simple power battle. Now, after that was the private banking system that started after the English Civil War, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The English Civil War was a massive event in world history, though many people don't realise the significance of it, and it meant that Britain became really the first merchant class run entire country, rather than just a small city-state or whatever. And one of the first things that they did was accelerate enclosure and privatisation of land. The next thing was 1694, was the incorporation of something called the Private Bank of England. It was a royal charter granted for 12 years, and it was the birth of fractional reserve banking in Britain. Now, fractional reserve banking means that the banks can actually lend out far more money than they actually have in deposits, so they can manufacture money out of thin air quite legally with fractional reserve and lend it out at interest. Now, if you can do that, it's impossible for you not to make a profit. Now, the idea of a fractional reserve is that you can only lend out a part extra of money that you don't have. Now, many of these banks now, nowadays the investment banks, are leveraged something like 50 times. So they have actually made up 50 times more money every year than they actually have in deposits, and they're lending this out at interest. So the banks are getting very, very greedy and fraudulent. So as soon as you introduce this kind of system into banking, which the Bank of England did back in 1694, what you're doing is you're embedding fraud into your money system. So not only have the merchants gained control of the land through privatisation, allowing them to privatise land, take it off the people for their own use, they've also now started to monopolise and control the money system. So the money that everybody needs in order to work, to live, to buy food, where they used to grow their own, is now also under control. So these are kind of a kind of two-pronged conspiracy against the people by the rich ruling elite. The idea is to keep this quiet, to keep it secret throughout history, so that they can continue this bind of taking more and more control of people's lives and taking away our freedoms. So that was 1694, incorporation of the Bank of England. Of course, it was supposed to be only existing for 12 years to help the king over a few problems, but it's carried on right to this day. Going on a few years to 1759, there was a massive expose of something called the Hellfire Club. Now, this was Medmenham Abbey near High Wycombe, and these guys were supposedly monks, but actually they were devil worshippers. They had satanic orgies, and most interestingly, Francis Dashwood, who was in charge of this club, they called the Monks of Medmenham, was Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time. And coincidentally, I mean, that was between 1762 and 1763, he was bringing in all sorts of cuts at the time, and very, very unpopular, not entirely unlike our Chancellor George Osborne today. So the idea that there are sort of sex orgies going on and something called the Hellfire Club, which starts to look like some kind of satanic organisation, right at the very top of British society, was exposed 100% back in 1759. Now, this is a long, long time ago, but of course lessons have been learned, and there's no reason to suggest that such clubs don't exist today, where powerful people are entrapped through sexual peccadilloes into these kinds of organisations, and then really their loyalty to the people is broken completely. So check out the Hellfire Club, 1759, Medmenham Abbey, near High Wycombe. And in fact, if you want, you can even go and visit the caves where these orgies took place and these secret meetings where the Chancellor of the Exchequer was plotting against the British people in High Wycombe. 1776 was the date of the formation of something called the Illuminati. Now, this was a German organisation originally. Adam Weishaupt was a professor of church law at Ingolstadt University in Germany. People think the Illuminati is just a conspiracy, but certainly there's lots and lots of information from the 1700s about how this organisation set about taking over European Freemasonry. So Freemasonry at the time was a sort of speakeasy club, and yet there were big conventions where the Illuminati said, well, look, actually, we want to be the governing body of Freemasonry right across the world. And also they were involved in all sorts of other things. Now, John Robison wrote a very good book called Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe. And I would suggest that this is one of the best sources for any information about any kind of equivalent of a modern-day Illuminati. Was Robison's leaks, because what he did is he actually got hold of original material written by these original conspirators, including the initiation rites that they did in German, and he was a fluent German and French speaker and translated them into English. So he did a fantastic job, Robison. He also was the secretary of the Royal Society in Edinburgh, a very well-respected Freemason. Didn't like the way that the Illuminati were attacking Freemasonry. He was also a close personal friend of the inventor of the steam engine, James Watt. He was a very well-respected member of society, an extremely good source on these kind of conspiracies. And so the title of his book again, which is available on the internet through sacredtexts.com, is Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe. And that's what the Illuminati were planning, was to take over any religion, all religions, infiltrate quietly, and the same with governments, so through political parties and also through the civil services of various countries. It's all in there if you care to have a look, and the techniques that they were going to use, secret liaisons behind the scenes to infiltrate. There's another book called The Code of the Illuminés, I-L-U-M-I-N-E-S, by Abbé Barruel. That's A-B-B-A-R-R-U-E-L, and that was published in 1798. Now, this might seem a long time ago, but these are really interesting source materials on organisations, of conspiratorial type organisations that can completely control government from behind the scenes, a kind of secret government. A parallel government that the press are not aware of, and that the people are not aware of, and that many honest politicians and churchmen are not aware of. Okay, so going on to 1789, and this is something that which the Illuminati were very much implicated in, was the French Revolution. They were seen to be operating through the Grand Orient Masonic Lodges in France to foment hatred of the French king. And it was also seen as, by some, as the revenge of the Templars, because, of course, it had been the French royal family which had ordered the arrest of the Templars hundreds of years before. So, I'm going to read you a little quote now about the French Revolution from this book, which is Denis Wheatley's Library of the Occult, actually by Denis Wheatley. This is an extract from an essay called The Devil's Secret Societies. What he says is, the Knights Templar were an order of chivalry founded for the rescue of the Holy Sepulchre. Their main base was Malta. In their decadence, perverted by evil successors to the early Grand Masters, initiates had to spit three times on the cross and swear allegiance to the devil in the form of a bearded idol named Baphomet. Their headquarters in Paris was a palace fortress called the Temple. King Philip IV had their Grand Master Jacques de Molay and many of his knights arrested there and brought to trial for heresy. They were burnt at the stake, but the order swore to be avenged upon the monarchy of France. 500 years later it was, from the tower of the temple, Louis XVI was taken to the guillotine, and the temple had been chosen for his prison. That was not a chance. The French Revolution was directed by the Masonic Lodge of the Grand Orient, which had inherited the championship of evil. Now that's from Denis Wheatley. Denis Wheatley, as a source, is actually very, very good. People like Montague Summers, Roland Ahmed, and Aleister Crowley himself, who were involved in black magic and occultism during the Second World War and around about that time, the 1930s, Wheatley actually personally interviewed these people, so I think he's actually quite a credible source and a credible witness to these events. By 1815, after the French Revolution, the enclosure of England was pretty much complete. That is to say, almost every single piece of land, field in Britain had actually been privatised and sold off. So that, you know, England really didn't have a peasantry anymore after that. Just to note that there is one village in Nottinghamshire which has still not been enclosed. That's owned by the Crown Estate, interestingly enough, and that's called Laxton in Nottinghamshire. If you go to Laxton, you'll find that the local people do actually have access to the local fields. You can walk around there. There's no restrictions on, you haven't got to stick to footpaths or anything like that. And you can see what a pre-enclosure village was like. That's the last one left. That's in Laxton in Nottinghamshire, near to Newark, if you're ever up that way. 1847 to 1851, the Irish potato famine, where we all know about the tens of thousands of people that died in the terrible conditions in Ireland. And of course, this was the kind of situation that this enclosure privatisation of land led to. Incredibly impoverished peasants just simply trying, who don't even own their own land, trying to eke out a living. In 1879, the Irish Land League was started by a guy called Michael Davitt. Now, the Land League, what they did was they were organised to basically to boycott and take back land, to fight for the right to stay on land and not be evicted and all this kind of thing. So it was one of the precursors to the Irish independence. And the Land League were very, very successful. Eventually, they lobbied their MPs, and the Irish used to, in those days, send MPs to Westminster, and they held the balance of power, rather like the Liberal Party does now in 2011. And through that power, what they did is they managed to get lots of land back to the people, arranged government loans to pay off the absentee landlords, the English lords mostly, Protestant English lords, and build a house on the peasants, on the poor farmers' own land. So overnight, what happened in Ireland was that the old farmers, the small farmers, owned their own land and built a brand new home on that property. And the repayments on those government loans were much less than the old rents they'd been paying to the old landlords. And they created really a model there for land reform in Ireland, which we should follow here in Britain. To give people security of tenure is absolutely basic. So they did that in Ireland. In 1888, the Highland clearances were horrific in Scotland. People were being burnt alive in their own homes as they were evicted, cleared out of the properties. And this, of course, was one of the final waves of enclosure, land privatisation going on in Britain. It was all stopped at the Battle of Skye. In the Isle of Skye, there was a very good organisation amongst the women of Skye, and when some people came to evict some police from Glasgow, the women organised to attack the eviction party, and then there was massive news coverage of it in the Times in London, the grievances of the Crofters, and there was a royal commission to look into the grievances of the Crofters, and the Crofting Acts, the Crofting Laws in Scotland were then put into force. Crofting is very different to the way we do things here in England. Because it means that you can't actually sell or buy your property, and it can't be used as security against a loan, because property, the croft, can only pass through your family. And if, say, for example, you don't have any descendants, what happens is the local crofters all get together and they decide who should be awarded that croft. It's not interchangeable for money. The land, crucially, is not interchangeable for money. This is the traditional system. So if you're ever up in Scotland, go and have a look at the crofting museums, go and talk to the crofters. They will explain to you how things should be done and how things used to be done here in Britain. And that was the natural way. They understood the very basic human right, which we seem to have forgotten about today, which is security of tenure. You have the right to stay, and you have the right to some land which you can call your own. So that was 1888, the Highland Clearances and the Battle of the Braes in Skye, which changed things around for the Scots. And of course, there's a burgeoning land reform movement now in Scotland which recognises the importance of this. So we have something now which many people would call a kind of new world order, which is an occultic kind of way of running things. We've got the Prime Minister at the moment, who's a member of the Bullingdon Club. We have George Osborne, who's the Chancellor. He's also a member of the Bullingdon Club. Boris Johnson, the Mayor of London, a member of the Bullingdon Club, and Mark Thatcher, also Thatcher's son, a member of the Bullingdon Club. So we've got a tiny elite running the country in Britain, and I think you'll probably agree that this is one of the most occultic governments we've ever had. And I'd just like to finish with something about the New World Order, written by Dennis Wheatley back in the Second World War. I actually wrote this during the Second World War. He says, "The New World Order, which they wish to bring about, is but another name for hell. If through them evil prevailed, every man and woman of every race and colour would finally be enslaved from the cradle to the grave. They would be brought up to worship might instead of right, and would be taught to condone or even praise murder, torture and the suppression of all liberty as necessary to the welfare of the state." And look at some of the executions that have been going on in Iraq recently, where we criticised Saddam beforehand for having executions. Incontestable proof of that has already been given us by the way in which the young Nazi-educated Germans have behaved in Poland, Czechoslovakia, Norway, Holland, Belgium and France. They butchered old men, women and children who did not even seek to oppose them. That was part of the plan, and they obeyed the order to commit these murders in cold blood without a single recorded instance of any protest against them by officers or men. 7 years of the totalitarian poison has been enough for the evil to grip 5 million German youths, and with it their hearts have gone cold and stony. If they triumph within 70 years, such words as justice, toleration, freedom and compassion will have ceased to have a place in the vocabularies of the races of mankind. All family life will be at an end, except for the conquerors, and the worst elements spiritually will be allowed to procreate fresh generations to populate a world divided into masters and slaves. The right to homes and children of their own would be reserved to the overlords. The rest would be herded into barracks and reduced to the level of robots, without the right to read or speak or even think for themselves. There could be no revolt, because every officer, priest, deputy, editor, magistrate, writer, and any other leader of free thought and action in the conquered country would already have been executed by the firing squads, and leaderless herds cannot prevail against tanks, tear gas, bombs, and machine guns. So that was what Dennis Wheatley was writing in 1941 about the New World Order. And, of course, the Nazis used the word world order, and this is a word which is being trotted out quite a lot today. So I think we just have to be aware of how we've got, where we are, where we may be going, and also the fact that there's not necessarily an end to the Nazi style of system just because they took off their uniforms. The Allies even tried to cover up the death of Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's successor after the Second World War. And many people were smuggled out who were war criminals to safe havens in South America and in the United States, and even in Wimbledon here in Britain. So I think we just have to be aware that the whole Nazi thing may not have gone forever. It may have just gone underground.